For everyone who loves books, this is Read On.
I'm Mark Billingham, and you're listening to RARNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, there's an air of menace about the show. Crime writer Mark Billingham gives us an exclusive preview of his new Tom Thorne thriller.
This new book, The Killing Habit, is directly inspired, not actually inspired, based on, not just a real case, but a real case that is ongoing.
Matthew Paris explores some great lives and tells us about Rudyard Kipling's troubled childhood.
He developed a really lively and fertile imagination, and he said he lived in his imaginary world because the real world was so horrible.
Narrator Emma Swan takes us back to a world of teddy boys and pop socks.
Bit of a rom-com, feel-good Champion Street market in Manchester. And yeah, it's got teddy boys the lot.
Chris Brookmeyer takes us into a world of heists and hacks.
Rather than all sorts of technical bells and whistles, it's often about getting somebody to reveal information, the value of which they don't appreciate.
And an educating Red suggestion leads me to discover a body in a trunk. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Mark Billingham is a top British crime writer. Every one of the 14 books in his Detective Inspector Tom Thorne series has been a bestseller. While his legions of fans await next month's publication of The Killing Habit, Mark has been busy narrating the audiobook version. So I pulled him in for questioning at the RNIB interview suite. Mark Billingham, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
So you're in the Talking Book Studios recording The Killing Habit, the latest Tom Thorne book. Can you give us a little bit of a teaser? Let us know what's in it.
Well, the previous book, a book called Love Like Blood, which I also did the audio recording for, was inspired by real case, which is not something I've done before, and I didn't think I would ever do it again, at least not quite so quickly. But this new book, The Killing Habit, is directly inspired, not actually inspired, based on not just a real case, but a real case that is ongoing and as yet unsolved, which is a perpetrator known as the UK Cat Killer. He was called the Croydon Cat Killer when he started, and then the M25 Cat Killer, but he now seems to have expanded his area of operations, shall we say, to the point where he's being called the UK Cat Killer. This is somebody who's killed at least 450 animals, mostly pet cats, also foxes, squirrels, whatever takes his fancy, presuming it's a he. And, of course, one of the things that the police are very keen on is, well, they're keen on catching this person largely because of the worry that he may move on to something else, because, of course, killing animals is one of the things that nascent serial killers are widely thought to do. So I thought this would be an interesting case to write about. I then got an in on the case through a contact with a retired officer who'd worked very closely on the operation. So I was able to talk to him. He gave me at least one outlandish theory that they're exploring, which I'm not going to reveal because it's in the book. And The Killing Habit is the, whatever, his 14th or 15th Tom Thorne novel. I can't remember.
I think it's 15. I've listened to each and every one as a talking or audio book.
You are a sucker for punishment.
Oh, absolutely. and you do produce one a year.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's an amazing work rate because you're also doing your film work and your comedy work as well, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I do other stuff, but I don't think a book a year is a hardship. I need to qualify that, which is that I'm one of the very lucky writers who writes full-time, you know, because I think something like 95% of published writers don't write full-time. They still have proper jobs. But because I write full-time, I've got kind of no excuse. I've got nothing else to do. I mean, yeah, I'm doing, you know, I play in this band and I do sort of comedy stuff and bits and bobs, but I can do my 1,000 words a day, and if you do that, a book a year is very achievable.
And you clearly enjoy spending time with Tom Thorne, and you share a lot of things with him, birthday, love of country music.
Oh, yes.
I mean, Agatha Christie famously wanted to kill off Poirot with every book that she wrote. Do you find living with Tom Thorne a bit like living with your brother? Or
I know what you mean. I mean, I do take a break from him every so often to write a standalone novel. And I think that's the way to do it, to keep yourself, well, you know, A, sane, and B, sort of interested in the character. Because the problem with a series character is the law of diminished returns. And we all know of series that are, shall we say, past their sell-by date, go on too long. You don't want to be that writer that writes one book or three or four books too many. And you love to think there's a voice in your head that will tell you when it's time to stop, but there may not be. So the way to do it is to step away every so often, do something else. You know, I do these other things that are collaborative, which is really good because obviously writing is an incredibly solitary thing. So to go off and work with another with four or five other crime writers in this band, or two or three musicians here and there, or whatever it is, gives me a break from that stuff.
I've got to ask you about the band. I was going to save it till last.
But okay.
The fun-loving crime writers.
Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, it was an accident. It started, there's a thing called the World Mystery Convention, which happens every year in a different American city. And a couple of years ago, it was in New Orleans. We were all having a great time. And on the last night, there was a gig in the House of Blues, incredibly famous venue in New Orleans. And the idea was that there was going to be this band, and then various people could get up and do a bit, various of the attendees at the conference. So me and another couple of writers, an Irish writer called Stuart Neville and a Scottish writer called Doug Johnson, said, let's get up and do a bit. We'll, you know, have a little show off. But the gig went very badly, and it wasn't quite what people thought, and people started to leave, and it all went a bit wrong. And then the lead singer of this band, as she was leaving the stage, went, "Where are the Brits? I hear there are some Brits here." So Stuart, Doug and I, together with a local drummer, shambled onto the stage and just busked our way through three songs, which I can still remember. They were Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon, Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash, and oddly, 500 Miles by The Proclaimers. And we just shambled our way through these songs. Anyway, and it went incredibly well. I mean, largely because of what we were following, I think. But it did go very well. And somebody put it on YouTube. And the next thing, we were getting contacted by the Edinburgh International Book Festival saying, "Right, I'm booking you lot for an hour and a half in August." And we went, "What? I mean, we've only got three songs, an hour and a half. And also, we're not a band, there's just three of us." So we put a band together. We knew a lot of crime writers who were musically gifted, who'd been in bands and stuff. So we recruited Val McDermid to come in, and Chris Brookmeyer, and Luca Veste, Liverpool writer, who's a brilliant bass player. And suddenly we had this band. We had a couple of days rehearsal, and we were off. And because at least three of the band, and I'm not one of them, are really, really proper musicians, the band is pretty good. You know, we're always a lot better than people expect when they think, "Oh, it's just those crime writers messing about." And, you know, we're a pretty tight band. And we do lots of cover versions. They're all about murder. You know, they're all about crime and murder, police, detectives. And we've been just playing a lot. And we've got a big run of shows coming up between now and the end of the year. We get booked at festivals, you know, so on the final night of a festival, after everybody's been listening to stories about violence and crime fiction or what noir is or whatever it is, they just let their hair down and we rock and roll like a bunch of old people we are.
And you sing as well as play the guitar?
I sing and play the guitar. So, I mean, actually everybody in the band sings. And we play for, you know, hour and 20 minutes with an interval because we need to lie down after 40 minutes. And it's just tremendous fun. But one of the things that makes it so enjoyable, we're all mates, we all get on, but it is that collaborative thing. Suddenly it's not just about you, and you can just have fun with four or five other people. And yeah, we are. It's so much fun that actually going back to writing the books is quite hard after we've done a few shows.
Now, Tom Thorne loves his country music, and it sounds as if that actually allows you to build your record collection. But I understand you're also a very, very keen collector of crime novels yourself.
Well, yes, and that's kind of how the whole thing started, was that I've got that collecting gene, I think. And so I used to collect first edition crime fiction. I mean, I was crazy about it. The American first, the British first, the Proof, the whatever. And eventually my wife said, "You've got to find some way to start getting these books for free. You know, they're taking over the house. It's using up all our money." So I started reviewing crime fiction, which means, you know, you start to get the books for free. And I became sort of just hanging around on the fringes of that community and getting to know everybody. And then once the final piece of the puzzle fell into place, which was actually writing one, suddenly I was a member of that community. It's a very odd thing. I mean, I remember going to interview big, huge writers, people like Michael Connelly and Ian Rankin, the writers who are now close mates. But, you know, I remember sitting there nervously with a tape recorder interviewing them, you know, 20-odd years ago.
And do you feel that was a kind of apprenticeship? Were you looking for hints and ins to a world that you clearly absolutely love?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I was certainly attracted. I mean, I write crime fiction because I read it. You know, I've always been a fan of it. But having met a lot of people, the writers, met some editors and agents and people around it, I realised what a nice kind of world it would be to join. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but crime writers are generally very collegiate and clubbable bunch, and we're hugely welcoming. It's odd. I mean, you know, I've now been doing it the best part of 20 years, but I still feel like a kind of new boy. It's odd. I like to keep imagining I'm a young buck, which is really rather tragic.
Having been to a couple of Crime Writers Association meetings, I've actually found that There's no arrogance assuming that you know everything already. Everybody is looking to swap anecdotes, to learn a bit more. I learnt an awful lot about forensic science by just a free meeting that I was invited along to. It's almost like you're all at college.
Yeah, and people do pass stuff on. I mean, oddly, we don't tend to talk about work that much. You know, get any bunch of crime writers in a room, they're much more likely to talk about music or sport or whatever. Maybe that's all writers do that. Maybe it's a sort of superstitious thing. You don't go, well, how's the new book going or whatever. But writers will share knowledge. I mean, within the Crime Writers Association, there is a kind of handbook which will reference which writers are experts about which subject. So if you want to find out about firearms, you call this guy. If you want to find out about poisons, which actually I do for the book I'm currently writing, you will talk to that person. So there is this kind of pool of knowledge about everything from, you know, forensics to committing the perfect murder.
How did you get into narrating your own book?
Well, that was an odd one. I mean, it was something that was mentioned way back at the beginning because I have a performer's background and I used to be an actor. It was sort of vaguely suggested, but I realised even then what a very hard thing it was to do and not something I could just go, oh, yeah, I can knock that off. So I didn't. I didn't for a long time. And eventually the book started to be narrated by a wonderful actor called Robert Glenister, and Robert just did a fantastic job on them. And then there was a TV adaptation. And the TV adaptation starred David Morrissey as Tom Thorne, who was absolutely brilliant. And of course, you know, with one eye on commercial aspect of it and so on, the publisher said, let's ask David Morrissey to start narrating the Thorne books. And David said, yes, great. And we were all set and there was a studio booked and everything. And then David got a movie or something and suddenly couldn't do the narration. So, of course, desperately, they went back to Robert. By that time, Robert had got a movie or something and he couldn't do it either. And I remember getting a phone call. How do you fancy having a go? And so I went in and that's it. I've done them ever since. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I always say to people after I've done it, it's always so much more exhausting than you think it's going to be, which sounds kind of odd because you're just reading. But for 3 days, solidly reading incredibly slowly, the kind of mental effort of that and the effort of trying not to trip over your words, to delineate different characters. You know, I should have learned by now because I know I'm going to narrate these books. But then I'll get in the studio and I'll go, why have I written a scene that's got 4 different Polish women in it? Or lots of people with very strong North Wales accents, which are incredibly hard. Or, you know, sometimes I just make a rod for my own back. But I do thoroughly enjoy doing it. And one of the things I do, and I don't know whether I don't think I'm unique in this, but I think it's something more people should do, is that I don't just record the audio book. I record an audio version of the book in that I will rewrite the book for audio because there are things that work in the book that simply won't work as a listening experience. You know, crime writers use this trick all the time, for example, when you're inside a killer's head, let's say, in the first person. Now, that killer has a voice, which on the page is just words. But once I give that killer a voice, and then the killer is in plain sight for the rest of the book, I've got a problem. So I will rewrite those scenes and change them from first person to third person, or take things out or put things in. There's always a little bit of rewriting that needs done, but I want people, when they read the book, to have the best time possible, and I want the people who are listening to the book to have the best time possible. So, yeah, I will make adjustments.
Yes, it can be a huge spoiler when you get the voice of the killer
on page
10 and you just go, oh.
That's Brian from the... Yeah, that's Brian who was working in the shop. And you can't cheat. I mean, yeah. There's no point cheating and changing his voice because why would he do that?
Well, that's right. He can't be a Geordie when you're inside his head and actually turn out to be Welsh.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. And it's only when... I don't think about it as I'm writing. I just try to write the best book I can, but then the audio publisher will read the book and go, ah, we do have a problem with chapters 12, 48, and so I will rewrite them.
And are you a fan of audiobooks yourself, or are you still very much a print man?
No, I listen to audiobooks in the car. I tend to listen to music if I'm on a train or on the tube, but on a long car journey, an audiobook is a wonderful thing. I listen to more non-fiction than fiction, and it's incredible the way a 5-hour journey can just suddenly, you go, what? How did I get here? I don't remember taking a turn off from the motorway. It's kind of worrying that you lose yourself in the book so much as you're listening. And I do think it goes back to this thing where we forget how wonderful it is to be told a story. I did a show last year that was me on stage with a couple of musicians who were doing songs, but essentially I was telling a story for half an hour. And the show lasted an hour because they were playing songs, but it was just me telling the audience a story. And people came up afterwards and said, it's so great to be told the story again, because that doesn't happen once you grow up. And I think we forget what a nice experience that is.
Well, I am very much looking forward to you telling me the story of The Killing Habit, which is out in a couple of weeks.
June the 14th, I believe.
Mark Billingham, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Now, for the first time anywhere, and exclusive to RNIB Connect Radio, here's a sneak preview of The Killing Habit, written and narrated by Mark Billingham.
The party was in full swing, the cash and carry booze flowing freely, and the buffet his wife had slaved over taking a hammering, when Andrew Evans spotted the Duchess and thought for a second or two that he was going to shit himself. That, or throw up on the spot. He was in the garden, watching the sun he hadn't seen in 18 months creep carefully down a plastic slide when he caught sight of her. She was standing at the open back door with a serviette in one hand and a drink in the other. She smiled and stood aside to let a teenage boy pass, then turned to look at Evans. She waved and raised the paper cup she was holding.
"It's going pretty well, isn't it?"
Evans' wife helped their son up from the bottom of the slide and shook her head as the boy immediately ran around for another go.
"Good turnout."
"Yeah. Lucky with the weather." She looked at him.
"You all right?"
"Yeah, I'm fine," Evans said.
"Why wouldn't I be?"
He reached across to stroke her bare arm, then downed what was left of his beer and crushed the empty can in his fist.
"Just going inside to get another drink."
The welcome home banner that had been strung across the small patio had begun to droop a little, and he was forced to duck beneath it on his way towards the back door. The old woman in the doorway stood aside for him, and he walked past without acknowledging her. In the kitchen, he grabbed the beer that he now very much needed and hugged his sister, who had clearly needed several already. Collared on his way back out by a couple of people he used to work with, he thanked them for coming, told them it meant a lot, and said he would catch up with them properly later. Then, though it was the last thing he wanted to do, Evans walked back outside, laying a hand on the old woman's mottled, fleshy arm as he passed, to let her know that she should follow him.
Thanks to Mark Billingham. A plentiful stash of Tom Thorne thrillers is available from the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats, including several talking books narrated by the man himself. Let's hope The Killing Habit joins them soon, and Mark will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, Christopher Brookmeyer on hacking and Matthew Paris pours a little scorn on Jacob Rees-Mogg. But before that... The RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden is always abuzz with the voices of the narrators who record our talking books, magazines and newspapers. Many have been recording that service for years, but others, such as Emma Swan, are comparatively new to it. However, as I discovered, she views being a narrator as something of a vocation. Emma, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, tell us about the book you've just finished recording.
Oh, I'm in a good mood, because after I finish, I'm like, whoa, I love doing it. But it's a real high when you just finish that last page, that last sentence. But yes, I've just finished That'll Be the Day by Frieda Lightfoot, my second title. And it was great. We've had a real laugh today. And it's been a week and a half working on that.
Judging by the title, that's set sometime in the 1950s,
yes, isn't it? Yes, absolutely. A bit of a rom-com, feel-good Champion Street Market in Manchester. And yeah, it's got Teddy Boys the lot.
Rah-rah skirts?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sticky out. It made me quite jealous. I want to change my fashion sense maybe for the rest of this week now.
You're tempted to come in costume, are you?
Well, maybe not for recording, because I think those skirts might actually make quite a bit of noise on the mic. But afterwards, a night out in one, definitely. Why not?
And as you said, that's the second title in the series. You recorded the first, which was Fools Fall in Love.
That's right, also by Frieda Lightfoot. In the same market with a couple of... So in this one, there's a few old faces, or for me, old voices now. But it's a new cast of characters, but the same place in Manchester. So, yeah, it's lovely. You feel like you really get to know the place, know the people, after doing two books now. Over 1,000 pages of Champion Street Market, so...
And is there a third one already published?
I think there is already. I think there might even be a third one in the Champion Street when I was reading the end bit of the book. I think there already might be another one out with a different narrator. But I think maybe Frieda, I think Frieda Lightfoot's written a huge amount of books. So hopefully there'll be more to come.
How do you go about preparing to narrate a talking book?
Narrating an audiobook, the preparation is, it actually takes a good while. Like I always leave myself at least a week and a half, if not two. To read it once, first of all, I was very lucky because I trained at Drama Studio and they have a wonderful department for voice work, and especially drama, radio drama and audiobooks. And a lot of the work I did on how to do something like a radio play, I put the same preparation into a book. So I read it first once and get to know it, and then go through it and break it up. So break it up in one instance with markings on the page for things like where to breathe, which words should be emphasised and things like that. But then also I have my multicoloured gel pen pack, which I highlight all the different characters. Each character has a different colour, and then on that, Peter Kenny, who I know has done a lot of talking books here, we had a coffee the other day and talked about our methods with characters, and he advised me to get a book because I do it on multiple pages of A4 paper, but basically to write down the character names and a little description of them with their colour, so then on the page immediately I know who's talking and what voice to go into. But I think my flatmates think I'm bonkers with all these colourful pages.
And where do the voices come from? Are you a bit of a magpie as far as picking up people's voices is concerned?
I think, yeah, and I think especially since I've started doing quite a few audiobooks since graduating, I'm really trying to tune in to what, I suppose, rather than thinking of it, when I first started, it was like, what accent shall I use? And now I don't think about it like that. I think, how do people speak? They might all be from Manchester, but people speak so differently depending on, I don't know, things like their... how they hold themselves in their body, or what jobs they do, or I don't know, there's little quirks, even if it's just that one character has a slower pace, one maybe articulates lots of words and is very jolly. You know, I always like to throw at least one Scouse character in there. Sorry, Frieda, if that wasn't what you intended, but there's always at least one. I think I've put two in this last one. But in London, there's so many, it's such a busy place that I might walk past someone and think, oh, that could be the policeman's voice today. So thank you to that person I walk past and nick their voice for a day in the studio.
What do you read for pleasure? Are you a rom-com fan?
I do. I do like a good rom-com. I think probably my favourite rom-com would be something quite cheesy like One Day, David Nichols. And there's a northern protagonist in that called Emma, so maybe I'm very biased. But also I'm a huge children's literature fan. Like even recently with the Paddington films being released, I went back and started reading the Michael Bond stories and just was like, I grew up on the words of Jacqueline Wilson and stuff, and just, yeah, big fan of writers as well, and children's fiction is something that I love. So actually often I'll be the weird mid-20s girl reading a Paddington book on the tube. Maybe I shouldn't be admitting that. I'm not very cool now, definitely not.
And was it reading as a child that made you fall in love with reading?
It did, yes. And I was also a massive audiobook fan when I was little, which I've only started to really think about recently, I suppose. I mean, I was obsessed with the Harry Potter books, but Stephen Fry's narration of them completely brought them to life. But I loved listening to audiobooks when I was little. So then when at drama school, and we did a few classes on it, I was like, this is like I'm a kid again. This, but I get to do the silly voices.
For you leaving drama school, was it a natural progression for you to go and work in the world of audiobooks?
Well, actually, for me, I've got RNIB to thank entirely for that, because prior to anything like I have now, a voice agent and things, but when I first left, I'd heard about the RNIB and their talking books and was recommended. My tutors at drama school said that it's a wonderful thing to do. So I sent an email to Rupert, and I know you've got a wonderful, wonderful pool of narrators of fabulous actors already, but I was determined to get him to reply. And I think I ended up calling him and saying, Rupert, he was like, you know what, you're super persistent, send me a voice reel. And then I came in for an audition, which I so enjoyed. And actually, I did an extract from One Day, funnily enough. I remember preparing it so nervously and so, yeah. And then since then, this is my second talking book, and also people here have helped me massively with, one, learning on how to do them, and also putting me in touch with other audiobook producers. So I really have RNIB to thank for getting me, hopefully now for the foreseeable future, will continue to do them. So thank you, guys.
And do you have any links with sight loss yourself?
My granddad has had quite serious sight loss in his older age. And I know that talking books has also been a big thing for them. Since, I know, in their retirement, they definitely, it fills their day with a joy, I think, with all the wonderful pool of narrators in the world. You know, they are in their little flat in Wickersley a lot, you know, for long periods of the day, but they'll listen a lot to books. And that's something that when I was younger, seeing other people of that age as well, and I know it's not at all just for that age, but that was my first experience of it. Your family, friends and things had said that the talking books really, really brighten their day. And why would it not, though, when even in the green room, when I meet the actors here, they've got these wonderful voices and the fantastic sound technicians who completely guide me as I go along and make me laugh with every chapter. I think it's amazing to have all those stories and voices in one place.
I sit just outside the green room when you're all having your lunch break.
Yeah.
And the camaraderie that comes there, you would think you guys were just putting on a Shakespeare play.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
But it's wonderful. You're all swapping tips and recommendations as well. You're all clearly very keen listeners to audiobooks.
Oh, absolutely. And I remember the first day I came in and recognised a few different actors here. I was like, oh, I was so nervous. I was clutching onto my book that I'd, you know, covered in gel pen. I was really, really nervous about it and didn't know these people will be so experienced and sort of thing. And everyone, when I said it was my first one, was like, oh, and sharing tips, like you say. And since that, it's actually been, like I said before, those people that have then gone, oh, and we advise you speak to those. But, you know, it is a bit like a little bit of a nice sounding voiced family. Very different voices, but yeah.
It's funny, actually. It's a question I always ask the narrators. Do you remember your first book and what it was? And invariably, everybody says yes.
Yeah.
And then they go, and I could have done it just that little bit better.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you can leave and go, oh, I should have picked that accent for that person or that voice. And you think, it's done. And, you know, actually, it is, though. It's conversations. Having a sound engineer who's the director of it, that's how I see them, is brilliant, though, because they really do guide you. And if there are moments where you're like, oh, I'm not sure I'm making the right choice with this character's voice, sound, anything, or even, for example, in Fools Fall in Love, there was quite a couple of quite emotional, I call them scenes, I know they're chapters, but some quite emotional scenes. And John here was brilliant at, you know, talking me through it. And I think that's a wonderful element that I'd certainly never considered about books before working here, that I presumed going in to do a radio drama, you'd have that chat with a director about what you're feeling and things like that. But here, you know, the directors are here for you to speak anything out loud. If you want to, you can stop and go, I'm going to actually take that completely different way. Or even just go, you're reading this well. Sometimes you just need, after a chapter, a strong cup of tea and say, no, it's fine. So, yeah, it feels very much a collaboration, not just the person reading the book, the people that tell you that, you know, well done, breathe and we'll have a minute before we do the next one.
You don't actually have a huge amount of time to record a 500-page book, do you?
No, not really at all. So I've been on this one total amount of time for about a week and a half, but I haven't been in every day. So probably 6 full working days, maybe. I don't know, would you say that amount of time? Maybe for it is being in the studio from 9:30 till 5 with a break. My friends always go, how do you not hate your own voice by the end of the day? And I do... Do you think afterwards, I think, oh, I'll have a quiet one because I have listened to myself just say words all day.
And have you got any idea what the next book in the pipeline for you to narrate is?
No, I do not know. So it's always this, being an actor, it's always this scary thing of you have about 3 or 4 minutes of celebration when you finish a job. So proud. Yes, and you know, you might take a photo. I always do a quite cheesy little photo, be like, it's finished. And then as soon as you get on YouTube, on the tube, you think, now what? But hopefully, normally, so far, touch wood, there's been another job round the corner. Another book of some sort coming up.
Emma Swan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Oh. Thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you for having me.
It was even noisier than usual on Champion Street Market. The stall holders calling out their wares, the Salvation Army band performing their normal Saturday morning routine, buses roaring by, splashing through puddles and soaking traders and customers alike. A brisk October wind slapping the wet canvas over the market stalls, making them sound like ships in full sail. So much noise and bustle that no one paid any attention as a young woman walked by, glancing longingly at the fish stalls with their colourful array of pink salmon, glistening white cod and plaice, yellow smoked haddock, the slate blue of cockles and glistening heaps of whelks and oysters. Pair of kippers for threepence, Chuck. Buy your pippins here, love. Best Cox's orange pippins in all of Manchester.
Fools Fall in Love by Frieda Lightfoot is TB24046, and That'll Be the Day will join it soon as TB24403. To ensure that you receive it as soon as it enters the RNIB library, why not add it to your wish list via Reader Services? Thanks again to Emma, and I'm sure we'll be hearing plenty more from her in years to come. Do you have a favourite narrator that you like to curl up and read with? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line and tell us more? Email readonair@rnib.org.uk or tweet producer Robert @talking_books. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
As we've already heard, one of Mark Billingham's fellow bandmates in the fun-loving crime writers is Christopher Brookmeyer. In 2016, his book Black Widow won the McIlvany Prize for Crime Fiction. His follow-up, Once You Gone, has just come out in paperback. And he told Robert Kirkwood all about it.
It's the 8th Jack Parlamain book, and it's a heist story, but it's also about hacking. Because every hack is a heist, and every heist is a hack. It's all about subverting security, but it's also about a 19-year-old girl that is quite shy and easily intimidated, and she wants to go off to uni, but just when she's about to, her mum gets into big trouble and she's left looking after her younger sister who's got Down syndrome. So instead of going to uni, she's taking on a really rotten job and dealing with the benefits system, and then she gets blackmailed by a hacker who's got compromising information on her, and so she's blackmailed to commit a crime, and Parlabane's blackmailed into committing a crime, and they kind of have to join forces. to pull off this very audacious heist. So it's about the dangers of anonymity online, that you don't know who you're dealing with. But also the upside of that anonymity is that somebody who's quite powerless in the real world can find ways to fight back in the online world.
Hacking is much more of a psychological exercise, much more talking to someone and trying to get them to reveal information.
Yeah, they call it social engineering, and it's often done very incrementally. It can be a kind of long con job, you know, that they can do their research, and rather than also as a technical bells and whistles, it's often about getting somebody to reveal information, the value of which they don't appreciate. And it can be done by the most subtle ways. Actually, there was a way that I put in the book, and I thought this might get criticised for being old hat, which was putting USB sticks, you know, leaving USB sticks around and waiting for people to pick them up. And you put the USB stick into your computer and there's malware on it. And it's a standard practice to tell people to not put, you know, USB sticks, that the provenance of which they don't know. But it turned out that during the US election, one of the ways the Russians hacked the Democratic National Convention was they used the same trick, but instead of leaving USB sticks, they made the people pay for them. What they did was it's really clever psychology, but they flooded the local area, all the newspaper stands, with really cheap USB sticks, so that people are buying it new, thinking they're buying something new and therefore safe, and the malware was already on it when they bought the USB sticks, thinking, oh, you know, $10 for 24 gigabytes. So it's always, it's like one of those things you say, well, how do you protect against it? Well, a lot of the time you can't, because they're always, you know, the successful hack will be a means of exploiting your own psychology in a way that you didn't anticipate.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and Chris Brookmeyer. For a list of books by him in the RNIB Library, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. You're listening to Read On. Coming up soon, the books of Mark Billingham's life. But first, I'm always keen to fill the gaps on my library shelves, particularly when I've heard good things about an author but haven't got round to reading anything by them yet. It's why I love to hear your educating read and hidden gem suggestions. So when Mr. Bean screenwriter Robin Driscoll appeared on the show recently and suggested a Michael Connelly thriller as one of the books of his life, I knew it was time to plug that particular gap on my crime fiction shelves. I tracked down Trunk Music in the RNIB library and downloaded the talking book via Overdrive. And from the opening paragraph, I knew I was on a roller coaster.
As he drove along Mulholland Drive toward the Cahuenga Pass, Bosch began to hear the music. It came to him in fragments of strings and errant horn sequences, echoing off the brown summer-dried hills and blurred by the white noise of traffic carrying up from the Hollywood Freeway. Nothing he could identify. All he knew was that he was heading toward its source. He slowed when he saw the cars parked off to the side of a gravel turnoff road, two detective sedans and a patrol car. Bosch pulled his Caprice in behind them and got out. A single officer in uniform leaned against the fender of the patrol car. Yellow plastic crime scene tape, the stuff used by the Miles in Los Angeles, was strung from the patrol car's side-view mirror across the gravel road to the sign posted on the other side. The sign said, in black on white letters that were almost indistinguishable behind the graffiti that covered the sign, LAFD Fire Control, Mountain Fire District Road. No public admittance, no smoking.
Harry Bosch is a tough, uncompromising LAPD homicide detective. Back after an involuntary leave of absence, he's eager to get his teeth into his first new case. When a Hollywood producer called Tony Aliso is found in the boot of a white Rolls-Royce, bound and shot twice in the head, Harry swings into action. At first it looks like a mafia hit, but as he digs deeper into the film producer's sleazy career, Harry quickly discovers that a lot of people had Tony Aliso in their sights.
including some who were supposed to be on the right side of the law. Then, just as he seems to have made a breakthrough, Harry's integrity is called into question and he's pulled off the case. But nothing short of a bullet can stop Harry Bosch when he's searching for the truth. Trunk Music is a page-turner from start to finish. Anyone who's a fan of the hard-boiled crime fiction of Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett and Lee Child will love it. Its twisting, pacey plot would do justice to any 1940s film noir, complete with femme fatale, sleazy dives and hard-talking tough guys. Harry Bosch has a lot in common with Chandler's Philip Marlowe. Both are uncompromisingly moral characters in a tawdry world, and the fact that they suffer because of it makes them more sympathetic and maybe even lovable. This side of him gives Bosch depth and makes him more than just a Dirty Harry figure. Trunk Music is the fifth book in the series and it was published in 2000. Only the references to what was then cutting-edge technology jarred as I read it. Otherwise, like all the best crime fiction, its plot is ageless. If at times it's a little far-fetched, then I was just too busy reading on to care. I'm already looking forward to picking up another book in the series. Trunk Music, narrated by Dick Hill, is TB14313. And there's a wide selection of books by Michael Connolly, including many others featuring Harry Bosch, in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, go to the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And if you like your detective fiction hard-boiled, why not try some of the following suggestions? The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. Widely regarded as one of the greatest crime novels of all time, it was also made into the archetypal film noir starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. The Talking Book version is read by Marvin Kane and is TB1165.
It was about 11 o'clock in the morning, mid-October, with the sun not shining, and a look of hard, wet rain in the clearness of the foothills. I was wearing my powder blue suit with dark shirt, tie and display handkerchief, black brogues, black wool socks with dark blue clocks on them. I was neat, clean, shaved and sober, and I didn't care who knew it. I was everything the well-dressed private detective ought to be. I was calling on $4 million.
The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. Written in 1930, this classic crime thriller follows hard-bitten private investigator Sam Spade as he tracks down a jewel-encrusted statue that has already cost Spade's partner his life. It likewise is narrated by Marvin Kane and is TB2467. Killing Floor by Lee Child, the first of the British writer's Jack Reacher novels, is about a former US military policeman with a dark past and a determination to hunt down his brother's killers. Killing Floor, written by Lee Child and narrated by Jay Benedict, is TB15483, and it's also available in Braille and giant print.
I was arrested in Nino's Diner at 12 o'clock. I was eating eggs and drinking coffee. A late breakfast, not lunch. I was wet and tired after a long walk in heavy rain, all the way from the highway to the edge of town. The diner was small but bright and clean. Brand new, built to resemble a converted railroad car. Narrow, with a long lunch counter on one side and a kitchen bumped out back. Booths lining the opposite wall. A door where the center booth would be.
Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Writer, broadcaster, former MP and avid llama farmer Matthew Paris is perhaps best known as the presenter of the radio show Great Lives. So it was fitting that I should meet him at Boswell, the world's only book festival devoted to biography and memoir. We began by discussing the new edition of his book Scorn, the wittiest and wickedest insults in human history. Matthew Paris, thank you for allowing us to crash your book signing.
Pleasure.
Now, you were talking about Scorn, the latest edition of a book that you first published about 20 years ago.
Yes, it was about 20 years ago. It's been through various editions, and then just a couple of years ago we decided we needed to cut about half of it out and put a lot more in. We didn't have enough women's invective, and there's some lovely women's invective. It isn't just Dorothy Parker, so it's almost a new book, this anthology, and I'm very happy with it.
Do you think scorn and invective is particularly British?
I think the English language is particularly rich in invective. It's scorn. It's not just the British. I mean, the Irish are actually better than us at it, and the Americans are arguably better than us at it. But it's either a language or a way of thinking, or both, that lends itself to invective. But you know, if I were a fluent French speaker, I bet I could come up with some lovely French stuff too.
Which pieces really stick out for you?
I read Dr. Johnson's letter to Lord Chesterfield, who had promised to be his patron, and you need a patron if you're writing the first English dictionary, and then given him no help. And it's a long letter, but it's the rudest polite letter in English literature. I have especially liked what you might call sustained invective. There's a wonderful Jewish curse against those people who have laid waste the beautiful dwellings of Yahweh, which is it's so moving. But I like the short ones too. I liked Dorothy Parker. I think it was Calvin Coolidge. I can't remember which American president it was, but he was a particularly boring man. And someone said to Dorothy Parker, "Calvin Coolidge has died," and she said, "How can they tell?" I like the short ones too.
I rather liked the one you said Robert Harris had said about Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Oh yes. A barmaid's idea of a gentleman.
I mean, presumably, Scorn is going to be a work in progress for the rest of your writing life.
I keep a little drawer in my office bureau, and every time I hear or notice, come across something good, I just write it on a slip of paper and pop it into the drawer. So maybe in a few years we'll do another.
Now, you're also very well known as the presenter of Great Lives on another radio station. I hadn't realised it's been going as long as it has been. Are there any authors whose great lives really stand out for you as well?
It has been going, I think, about 16 years, but I've only been doing it for about 12 of those 16 years. Are there any authors? Gosh, no. I mean, I'd love to do Mark Twain, and no one has chosen Mark Twain. I want to do George Eliot, no one's chosen her. Charles Dickens, no. You know, one of the problems with authors is they just sit there scribbling all the time, and as a result, their lives may not be as interesting as the books into which they pour all their energies. One I'd love to do, and this would be an interesting life, would be Dylan Thomas. I mean, it's such a bad boy in so many ways, but what a life.
And, of course, there's Rudyard Kipling, who had a rather tragic beginning to his life.
Another author who John Major was my guest, chose Rudyard Kipling. I had never realised that poor Rudyard, just at the age of about five, and his little sister were put into foster care by his parents, who were in the Indian Colonial Service, with a couple in Portsmouth who turned out to be complete sadists. They kept trying to catch little Rudyard out and then shouting at him, and they made him parade through the streets of Portsmouth with a big placard saying, "I am a liar," on it. It destroyed the little girl, who became mentally unstable and never really recovered, though she was a good poet. But it made Rudyard Kipling, who said that because he had to be making things up all the time to try and escape the wrath of his foster parents, he developed a really lively and fertile imagination, and he said he lived in his imaginary world because the real world was so horrible.
And are there any blind people who have featured on Great Lives?
We did Louis Braille, and that was a fascinating, absolutely fascinating life. There's a lot more to Louis Braille than Braille. I recommend anyone that hasn't read a biography to do it.
You revealed that you're working on a new book that has arisen from Great Lives.
I have discovered that a really surprising proportion of the great lives whom my guests choose seem to have crawled from the wreckage of absolutely disastrous childhoods. I mean, Louis Braille had a pretty rough time himself. And you would not expect so many totally unsatisfactory childhoods to have produced quite so many geniuses, and I'm pursuing the possibility that there's a link.
Thank you very much for being a guest on Read On.
Pleasure.
Thanks to Matthew Paris. His collection of great parliamentary scandals is available in Braille from the RNIB Library. And his other books, such as the latest edition of Scorn and The Spanish Ambassador's Suitcase, Stories from the Diplomatic Bag, are available in print, audio and ebook formats wherever you buy your books. Now it's back to Mark Billingham for the books of his life. So, Mark, was there a book that you read as a young man that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, there was, but the interesting thing is it was a book that was read to me, and it was The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. We had a, shall we say, rather eccentric maths teacher at school who would get bored during his own lessons, and halfway through the lesson he would literally stop teaching us about quadratic equations or whatever it was, reach into a battered leather bag and pull out this copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes and read us a Sherlock Holmes story, of which there are, you know, 56 or something, so there was plenty of it. And I just thought, this is amazing. I mean, probably because it was better than maths. But I just fell in love with that character, with crime fiction generally. He read them so wonderfully and with such enthusiasm. And, you know, I didn't know at the time what an influential book that was or how much of an influence it would be on me. But it's simply true to say I wouldn't be a crime writer if it hadn't been for that teacher and his passion for Sherlock Holmes.
"My dear fellow," said Sherlock Holmes, as we sat on either side of the fire in his lodgings at Baker Street, "life is infinitely stranger than anything which the mind of man could invent. We would not dare to conceive the things which are really mere commonplaces of existence. If we could fly out of that window, hand in hand, hover over this great city, gently remove the roofs, and peep in at the queer things which are going on, the strange coincidences, the plannings, the cross-purposes, the wonderful chains of events working through generations and leading to the most outre results, it would make all fiction, with its conventionalities and foreseen conclusions, most stale and unprofitable."
Many editions of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's brilliant detective stories are available in a full range of formats from the RNIB Library, including this recording of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, narrated by Robin Holmes, which is TB 137. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, I never get tired of rereading The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, which is, it constantly tops lists of the greatest mystery novel ever written. It was certainly hugely influential. It kickstarted the whole hard-boiled movement. There would be no Raymond Chandler or Ross Macdonald without that book. But it's also a great book, you know, not just an important one. It has the greatest MacGuffin in the history of crime fiction, which is this Maltese Falcon. The book really isn't about the hunt for this falcon. The mystery at the heart of it is, who is Sam Spade, this iconic detective who only appeared in one novel and one novel only? And he's morally so incredibly dubious. He's just about the most likable character in a book full of unlikable characters. Wonder, you know, the archetypal femme fatale and the fat man and Joel Cairo. We all remember the movie with Bogart. And, of course, Bogart is nothing like Sam Spade in the book, who is referred in the book as a blonde Satan. It's a wonderful book. It's a very short book. You can read it in an afternoon if you sit down and do nothing else. And I've reread it many times.
Samuel Spade's jaw was long and bony. His chin, a jutting V under the more flexible V of his mouth. His nostrils curved back to make another smaller V. His yellowish-gray eyes were horizontal. The V motif was picked up again by thickish brows rising outward from twin creases above a hooked nose. And his pale brown hair grew down, from high, flat temples, in a point on his forehead. He looked rather pleasantly like a blonde Satan. He said to Effie Perrine, "Yes, sweetheart?" She was a lanky, sunburned girl whose tan dress of thin woolen stuff clung to her with an effect of dampness. Her eyes were brown and playful in a shiny, boyish face. She finished shutting the door behind her, leaned against it, and said, "There's a girl wants to see you. Her name's Wonderly." "A customer?" "I guess so. You'll want to see her anyway. She's a knockout." "Sure in, darling," said Spade. "Sure in." Effie Perrine opened the door again, following it back into the outer office, standing with a hand on the knob, while saying, "Will you come in, Miss Wonderly?" A voice said, "Thank you," so softly that only the purest articulation made the words intelligible, and a young woman came through the doorway. She advanced slowly, with tentative steps, looking at Spade with cobalt-blue eyes that were both shy and probing. She was tall and pliantly slender, without angularity anywhere. Her body was erect and high-breasted, her legs long, her hands and feet narrow. She wore two shades of blue that had been selected because of her eyes. The hair curling from under her blue hat was darkly red, her full lips more brightly red. White teeth glistened in the crescent her timid smile made. Spade rose, bowing and indicating with a thick-fingered hand the oaken armchair beside his desk.
Marvin Kane narrating The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, which is TB2467. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
There are a number of books I've read recently, all by the same person, and I just want to recommend this author, Mick Herron, who writes this wonderful series of spy novels featuring this character, Jackson Lamb. But I'm currently reading his forthcoming book, which is out very soon, I think in a few weeks, which is called This Is What Happened, which is a standalone. And he's just one of those writers who, you know, you... Again, a day can go past and you barely look up from the page. He's sickeningly good. Yeah, so I would start with the first Jackson Lamb novel, which is called Slow Horses.
Slow Horses by Mick Herron is available commercially in print, ebook, and as a downloadable audiobook narrated by Sean Barrett. Mark Billingham, thank you for sharing your encyclopedic knowledge of crime fiction with the Read On listeners, and best of luck with the new book.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.